Today's show comes to you thanks to Ovakind, an online shop for emerging design. For more information, visit ovakind.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leti Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Leti Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, restaurants, big brand startups, all of those doing what's most innovative and delicious. And today, instead of the Green Market, we'll do a little Aspen Food and Wine classic reminiscing with the beloved Richie Nakano. He's at Line Cook on Twitter, of Hapa Ramen, at Hapa Ramen, in San Francisco. And you can reliably find his food truck at the Ferry Building. He's opening a brick-and-mortar restaurant called Hapa in September of 2014. And then we'll have here in the studio Chris Jekyll, chef partner of one of my very regular haunts. I think they're getting tired of seeing me around. The Venetian tinge with Japanese place, Alanda. Venetian, Japanese. It's a lot more straightforwardly downright delicious than it sounds. Last a head chef of Michael White's I, Fury. This fella has worked with the likes of Larry Forgione and at places like Tabla and 11 Madison Park. And we're going to talk about biking, his very precious brain, and his favorite human being in the whole wide world, and that's Mom. Stay to the end, because we'll wind it down with Chris here to talk about what he actually really likes to drink, because chefs drink more like regular people. And now, here is Richie Nakano at Cochon 555, where chefs compete to see who cooks their heritage breed pig the best. This competition travels all over the country, and the finale ends up in Aspen. And he talks about one of Heritage Radio's topics of 2014, and that is waste. And being Hapa and cooking and feeding us ramen, we like everything about Richie. Your lips will stick together when you eat his food.
Yeah, I mean, for us, since we get everything from farmers markets or from, like, local ranchers, and we're friends with them, it would be really rude to waste anything that they grow for us, so we try to use everything. Also, it's really expensive, so we also try to use everything that way, too. So, but no, I mean, like, there's no reason to waste. You should use every single part of everything.
Well, so what are some examples that you go above and beyond a typical restaurant?
Like, for us, like, when we bring in whole animals, we, like, skin the whole animal and use all the skin for different things, making collagen stocks, things like that. Stems from our produce, we ferment into pickles, stuff like that, make kimchi out of it. We do a lot of different stuff, so, and sometimes my staff hates me for making them do it.
Right, because what is it like to even skin the whole animal like that? I mean, it's not so easy, right?
It's not so easy. You need a really sharp knife. You need to be really patient. But I enjoy doing it, because then you can take the big piece of skin you take off and, like, you're like, I made you a sweater.
What, for me?
For you, yeah. I can make your whole vest.
Parts of it are furry, like, hairy, and it's the natural variations in the hide.
It would keep you really warm.
I'm not to be blamed upon Richie Nakano.
Right.
They're natural variations.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So tell me about, the taco. I was really crazy about it. And I could tell that it was made from bits. So
yeah. So the taco we made tonight, we made carnitas out of the shoulder, which is pretty straight up. So we rendered all the pork fat out and then cooked the carnitas in that pork fat. But then we took all the skin that we took off the pig, and we braised the skin, and then we, like, julienned it, so that goes in there. And then we took the pig ears, and we braised those, and then julienned those, and those go in there, too. So it's actually three different types of pork mixed together to make one taco filling.
With extra, like, mouthfeel and, like,
super collagen-rich, like, your lips stick together when you eat it kind of thing, yeah.
Which is what I like in my Taiwanese beef noodle stew.
Exactly.
And no one ever does that.
No one ever does that, because what makes that stew great is the tendon, right? So they put all the tendon in the soup, and it makes it taste really great and sticky. So
what are the white people saying about this today?
They've been really nice. The white people have been really nice. You know, the hardest critic is the Asian.
Okay. So what have we been saying about it, besides myself?
They've been really nice, too. They've been really, like, they play their cards really close to their chest, you know? So
right,
like,
because it's a competition.
Yeah, so, like, they would never tell you who they voted for.
But, of course. They're like, hi, Richie. We're friends and everything, but I might have put my token in someone else's box.
It's true. Exactly. So, but everyone's been really nice this time.
Welcome back to the studio. I'm your host, Leyte Sue, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. And now for People We Like. We have here live in the studio, Chris Jekyll, chef partner at Alanda, the Venetian Japanese restaurant near Union Square. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Leyte. How are you today?
Good.
Good, good. Bubbly as always.
Oh, thank you. I was allowed to say all that I said with Richie because I am Asian.
Is that, it gives you the official pass?
Yes.
Do I get that pass because I'm dating an Asian?
Oh, wow. Okay, I want to know how you met her because I've met her before and she's fantabulous.
Okay, Cupid, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, this is one of those things where, like, I don't know if love at first sight is the right word, but, like, we met each other, and it was like this, you know, I've always thought, like, dating people my entire life was sort of like, oh, what do my friends think? Well, I don't know, maybe they won't like her, is she cute enough, is she not cute enough, blah, blah, blah.
Whoa.
And, well, it is just a thought process, right? And then she walked away, and I was sort of like, you know what, I don't think I care.
Wait, what do you mean she walked away?
Well, like, we had our first date, and she was going away, and these thoughts always run through my head while you're meeting people and potentially dating them, and she was walking away, and I was like, what are my friends going to think? And the thought crossed my head, I was like, I don't really care what my friends are going to think. And that was sort of the first time I've ever had that reaction when I met someone, and...
Oh, wow.
So, like, I wouldn't say that was, like, those words per se, but it's certainly the thought process was there, and... You know, 2 years later, actually 2 years, our 2 year anniversary was Friday, just 3 days ago. So we're, she's good.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
And, so this is, let me rephrase this. This is a, I don't give a fuck what other things that people think, at first sight.
Yeah, I guess sure. That's a good way to put
it. Lots of hyphens.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And she's still with you after you opened your own restaurant. So congrats to her in that. You know, certainly the other day when we sat down to catch up, I noticed that you turned your face when I asked you, "Hey, so what were you most scared about when you opened your own spot?" And you turned your face to the side, and your face got like way redder. And you, like, took a deep breath.
Well, I mean, she was certainly involved in what made me nervous. You know, I sort of... Lots of things make you nervous. You know, when you're about to put 110 hours, 120 hours a week into something, you kind of... Other things seem to slip away, you know? And that's... I'm very fortunate that she is understanding and hardworking in her own right and sort of has compassion for the fact that I'm not going to be around at certain points because it's... You know, for the best, for the long term, it's for the best. And so in that sense, I'm very, you know, lucky to have someone that's equally as ambitious, I guess is probably the right word for it, because she's very ambitious in her own right in regards to what she does, and also very understanding.
Hmm. And what industry is she in?
She's in fashion. So she is a demand planner for Saks Fifth Avenue. So she organizes all fragrances and cosmetics for the company. So she's like... She is, so she basically looks at spreadsheets and figures out who gets what and where, this is how much goes to this store and why, and manages budgets and how much gets spent and all the fun stuff.
Yay! And I'll mention there's another, our chef friend, Sule Fett Schrader over at Kio. His wife is in fashion as well.
So is Mark Forgione.
Oh, really?
Yes, she works at Moschino. She used to work at Moschino anyway. Last time we had dinner, I think she might have been leaving. But I guess it's a thing.
So now you're hitting your stride in such a beautiful way at Alanda, and I can't believe it. Like, your uni pasta actually objectively gets better and better every time I have it. So it's,
thank you.
It's
part of that comes with the sort of the understanding and getting your feet wet and consistency. And but I chalk most. We've been getting more positive reviews via social media than we've ever had before, which I sort of chalk up to us relaxing a little bit, if that makes sense. And I mean, we're certainly just as busy as we were before, which is a blessing. But I think it's sort of getting more comfortable in our own skin. You know, at the beginning in the review process, you really, is it good enough? Is it not good enough? Is there 27 grams of egg yolk in that sauce? Or is it 32 grams? You know, and you really get sort of looser in a sense. Not too loose, obviously, but you get sort of this understanding and comfort level and happiness, per se, that sort of says, you know what, this is just good. I don't really care what people think because you're not under the microscope anymore.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You are in the sense that with Yelp and all these other sort of things, but you're no longer critically being scrutinized by every newspaper and every magazine. And so I really chalk the fact that I think that we're getting better to that, a comfort level and like an ability to sort of do things that make us happier, per se.
Mm-hmm. And everyone who's coming in is more relaxed because they're not like, well, I just, you know, read about them on Eater every day for the last 2 weeks, so show me what you got.
Yeah, agreed. although we seem to still get some solid play on Eater, and thank you to Eater for that. But, you know, it's you know, word of mouth, I think, is really what's driving business.
Word
at
of
this
mouth.
Point. Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. That's exactly why I named my show what I named my show. Although some good friends who are good at words made sure I didn't call it World of Mouth because I was trying to get too clever and that would have...
Don't over... This goes back into what we're talking about.
Don't overthink it.
Why the restaurant's getting better. We were overthinking it. Don't overthink it.
I want to take a quick minute here to share with our Word of Mouth audience some Word of Mouth worthy events coming up. So Restaurant Week and Champagne, Chefs and Champagne.
Sure. So Restaurant Week is something that we... made a decision to do sort of last minute, per se. And it's really sort of driven by the fact that we do a market menu already, which is something we do every day for lunch, and it's seasonally driven, and it's what's available in the market. And I go myself every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, personally, before lunch service, and say, you know, what's available and what's there. And then it gives us an opportunity to sort of test things at lunch, et cetera. So it was a natural fit for us to, you know, give Restaurant Week a shot in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
The only real limitation to me about Restaurant Week is the fact that I think the freeness of the menu might be a little bit more limited, but it was a natural progression for us to participate in our own right. And we're sort of, you know, we chose to go a different route and not necessarily going through NYC Go. We've just sort of left it as an amenity for our guests.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of a...
So you're not listed on that big list?
No, we're not.
Okay.
So the idea is sort of, you know, someone calls and makes a phone call and says, hey, are you doing it? Then yes. And we think it gives us an opportunity to interpret it in our own right.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still sort of working through what that's going to be and how. And you know, there's certainly a menu available, both lunch and dinner. But it's sort of, you know, do we offer smaller portions, for instance, is something we're discussing of our a la carte menu at the limited price. So you get to actually experience the actual restaurant
right.
in smaller versions. And so we're really having a lot of conversations about what we want to do with this because we're not limited to what New York City Go requires in that sense.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chefs and Champagne this weekend?
Yeah, that was something, you know, I'm new to do this being my own show.
Woo!
I guess. So, yeah, it's nerve-wracking and exciting. And this is the first toe dip into the James Beard Foundation. So
okay.
I've known Shelley Manigin, who does like sort of off-premise events for James Beard, and
mm-hmm.
she's sort of... I've volunteered for certain meat purveyors and certain restaurants, and I've never been sort of one of the features. And she approached me, and I absolutely said yes for multiple reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the James Beard Foundation,
right.
number one.
Right.
Number two is I get to escape to the Hamptons for a day, which doesn't suck, you know. And so it's just a sort of – and it gets – summertime is an opportunity to get my face and the restaurant's name out into the public – of people that are not necessarily in town now, but will be in town come fall, and that really, I think, is going to be a benefit for us.
So I personally appreciate how open-minded and participatory you and your partners, the Chadros, have been, because I want to say thank you again and announce that we did raise over $8,000 for Heritage Radio Network and Rose Charities, because Chris and his team so generously donated their time and space and wonderfulness.
I mean, it was really a win-win for us. You know, you were looking for a Sunday. We're not open for brunch. It just, it, and to be able to donate our space when we're not, it's not like we're losing revenue for that point. And, yeah. and it's an opportunity for you to raise money and an opportunity for us to get out. And it's really something that we just looked at and said, this is good for everyone. And there's no, absolutely no reason why we shouldn't do it. And it turned out to be a great party. And we really, really, we really enjoyed ourselves. And that's really the most important thing.
And I also appreciate your frankness. You're pretty frank.
Well, I'm a New Yorker. You don't survive and grow up in New York and not be, you know, I don't know if brash is the right word, but you certainly are not afraid to speak your mind.
I'm from California, but I'm feeling like I really fit in here. I'm feeling good, like a fish in my water. So going back to first words out of your mouth, Asian women, food world, you know, you're like the only person that I could really ask about this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like, do you think there's like a thing? Like, do you think there's a special place for Asian women in the food world? Like, why are there so many Asian women in the food world? Or just so many Asian women, period? Like, is it a phenomenon?
Phenomenon. I don't know if that's the right word for it. I mean, I can certainly give you a reason, rationale as to why I am in this, the relationship that I am.
Okay.
And that's sort of, I've always... You know, if you look through my background in terms of culinarily, I'm a very curious person. You know, Indian food, French food, Italian food, Japanese food. You know, and it really was, I'm always sort of trying to understand cultures. And quite often that's through food, but just as a general statement. And I find that, at least with the majority of, not all, but certain Asian cultures anyway, I find that I get intellectual stimulation
mm-hmm.
in all senses, mm-hmm. as well as cultural stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily find that I've gotten that from other cultures, per se. You know, so, and that's really, for me, what it is. I think that, you know, I get this opportunity to sort of experience... Lindsay's parents were not born here, you know,
yeah.
So they have these food, you know, we go to their house and we do hot pot on Sunday, and that's not
hot
something something I never would have, you know, I would not have experienced in that visceral sense, like in a home sort of
yeah.
situation without, you know, dating someone that's not, you know, she was born in the States, but her family was their first generation. So, you know, it's not something I would have experienced if I had been, let's say, I grew up on Long Island and I was dating somebody I grew up with. You know,
yeah.
it's sort of like the culture is really similar. And,
right.
And the intellectual level, I find, is stimulating also with the majority of Asian cultures. And that's to me, is the two most important things. One, I get cultural. And B, I can, like, you know, we can talk about, be it the stock market today or what's happening in Israel or whatever.
Wow.
And that's something that I found that I didn't necessarily get from a lot of other cultures, and that's really what I found the most intriguing.
That is so illuminating, and I'm also, you know, I like different colors of crayons in my crayon box.
Yeah, it's important.
So I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I hear you. You're from Long Island.
I am.
I love the Ford's iced tea.
Oh yeah, it's my grandmother's recipe.
Ah.
So that's something that I don't know whether I'm fortunate or unfortunate to have my parents were divorced when I was young, when I was 7. So
that's the roughest age. It's like
I mean it's hard. I mean, it just depends on what your personality's like and,
mm-hmm.
and how you take it. It certainly was not easy. But I was raised by, you know, my mom had not finished school when my parents got divorced. She was 27 and she had turned 28 3 days before I was turned 7. So she was not even 28 yet. So she hadn't finished school. She hadn't finished college. So my mom was all of a sudden left in a situation where, you know, the divorce wasn't pretty. Let's just leave it at that. And my mom was all of a sudden left mm-hmm. in a situation where she had 2 children, a mortgage to pay, and she hadn't finished her schooling yet. So she really got put in a situation where, what was she going to do? So she worked at night and worked during the day, went to school at night. So this is where Ford's Iced Tea really has a special place for me, because I went to my grandparents' house every day. We were fortunate enough to have my grandparents close enough by where I could go there every day. So
mm-hmm.
so I went, I took one bus to elementary school. I took a different bus home from elementary school. I took that bus to my grandparents' house. So, and my grandfather's last name was Ford. So it was Grandma Ford to me. And that's just what it is. And that's sort of a tribute to her in that sense. It's one of those, you know, she did lots of cooking. She was a, She was an Italian-American. My grandfather was not, obviously, with the last name Ford, but she was. And so she was the stay-at-home, quintessential American housewife in the 50s and 60s and 70s or whatever. And she turned back into that, essentially, in the 80s when my brother and I went there every day. So so we'd come in and, you know, the coffee would be brewing in the old-school aluminum coffee pot. And, you know, and it sounds silly, but I have very vivid memories of that. There was a garden in the backyard, and... And those are things I don't think American children growing up in the 80s really got to experience a lot. So when I say I was fortunate and unfortunate, I think that it helped me, in some sense, have a different appreciation for food because I was not eating, you know, microwaved TV dinners and McDonald's, for instance, when I was a child. And I think that a lot of people my age group were, at least in urban environments or semi-suburban environments, that was something that was happening. So that's my little, that's the easiest way and one of the closest things for me to sort of put a tribute to my grandmother, because I do think she had a specific place for me in terms of how I ended up appreciating food.
Mm-hmm. And then your mom is like this ridiculously strong...
Yeah, my mom's a trooper, man. My mom, how many people... that end up put in a situation where they haven't actually had a college education at 28 and have two children and a mortgage to pay end up on welfare or end up like being subsidized by the government or, and my mom really sort of looked at herself and looked at her life and was like, pardon my language, but there's no fucking way I'm going to let my family grow up like this. That's just what happened. And she was just, so she went to work every day and she, like, you know, tightened her belt and picked up her bootstraps and was just
she
like, that's it.
She went to go work for an accounting firm from the bottom up, right?
Yes. That man's name was Seymour Schwartz. He passed a while ago, but my mom went to work for him while she was still going to school. So she worked for him during the day and went to school at night, passed her CPA exam. He eventually made her a partner. She retired. She took the firm over by herself. A few years after that, a larger accounting firm tried to merge with my mother and tried to buy her. You know, I'm sure the deal was pretty good, and my mom said no.
Wow. Hard to get.
Well, I mean, yes and no. A few years later, my mom took 20% of that company and two other partners. So my mom's kind of a shark in that sense. My mom is a very... I mean, I can't say she was emotionally there for me when I was a child, but that's a whole different subject. She was never not there whenever I needed her to be there, and there's no one in the world that I have more respect for than her. She's really just, you know, the first woman on the board of the New York State Society of Certified Public Accountants.
Right.
You know, like, very, very special, hardworking lady, and I'm happy that she is in a position where she is growing comfortable, although she will probably never retire. If you're listening, Mom, I don't think I told you about this, but anyway.
Well, the New York Times, there's an article that you can share with your mom which I love, is that people who live with purpose just like have longer lifespans.
I absolutely agree, and a lot of people are surprised to hear that the average lifespan of a New York person in the five boroughs is 5 years longer than the national average.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I love that.
And I really believe that it's just something like, yeah, there's smog and there's traffic and all those other things that are supposedly bad for you. But people live longer here, which, I mean, some of that might be better health care. There's lots of potential factors there. But I really think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people have a purpose and somewhere to go every day. And even if they're not working, it's still like you get up and you leave your house and you go get a cup of coffee across the street and you see your neighbors.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really think that that has... purpose has a lot to do with it.
I must stay alive to try every pizza in all of the five boroughs.
whatever works.
Whatever floats your boat.
Something's doing it, for sure.
I want to share some social media info with you all. Chris Jaekle is at CJAECKLE. Whew. That was hard. And Alonda is at ALLONDANYC. As always, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. /WOMSHOW on Facebook as well. And on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at LEITIHSU. That's Leiti Sue. That's me. Stay close, because after this commercial break, we'll talk about why Chris is so thankful for his brain and why he loves to bike.
Interested in emerging design? Check out Ofakind, a site that sells the pieces and tells the stories of up-and-coming makers. The site has featured over 200 designers and offers limited edition pieces that you can't find anywhere else, along with studio tours, travel guides, and even recipes from the designers. To find out more, head to ofakind.com and sign up for the site's newsletter.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Leyte, I'm your host, and I'm so pleased to have here live in the studio Chris Jekyll, chef and partner of his very own restaurant, Alanda. Hi.
What's up?
So, I want to learn more about your love for biking. So, you bike a lot, both competitively, like, Or long distances?
Not competitively per se, but certainly long distance.
Okay.
I try to do at least one century a year, which is a 100-mile bike ride.
Yeah, and when you say one century a year, I'm like, what do you want?
So I try to do at least 100-mile ride a year.
Okay.
And it's usually for charity.
Okay.
The last seven or eight I've done for the MS ride, which is for multiple sclerosis. I have a friend from, an old friend, 15 years or so, whose mother has MS. So we you know, we do a decent job trying to fundraise. And, I mean, the two of us, not last year but the year before, were the highest earning non-sponsored team in the MS ride, mm-hmm. which was almost, between the two of us, was almost $10,000, which is pretty solid for two guys that are just riding their bikes for 100 miles without corporate sponsorship or anything like that. So
you just did that through friends and family?
Just through friends and family,
That's
yeah.
awesome. Mm-hmm.
So that one is the one I do most often. I've done the North Fork Century a couple of times, which on Long Island. So that's sort of the tour of the wine country, and that one's really pretty easy, except for the wind, because there's very few hills.
Uh-huh.
But really, my passion for cycling sort of grew out of necessity, which is something that, you know, I've always been reasonably ambitious. I guess that's probably clear based on what I do and where I am. But I sort of have set goals for myself, and cycling was always one that was
How
sort
old are
of,
you?
I'm 36.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I always set goals for myself about trying to get something. And I what I've done with my life and chosen was always sort of a, you know, there's no rapid way to get there. There's no like, oh, I'm going to get rich and it doesn't matter. I can just spend money. So I always lived on a limiting income being a cook. And I'm sure we've all know what our salaries are like when you're a cook. It's certainly not pretty. So I sort of made a decision in my early 20s that I wanted to own a piece of property. I didn't want to, you know, just throw my money away paying rent to somebody that I would never see again.
Ahead of the game, the curve.
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. You know, I used to dream of having my own restaurant at 29, and I didn't get there till 35. You know, so like it depends on the goals you set for yourself, for sure. But I got there.
You still look young.
Yeah, well, except for the gray everywhere. So cycling really was built out of the necessity in the sense that I looked at a situation and I said, I did my budget and I looked at it and I said, okay, this is how much money I spend on travel a month. This is how much it's going to cost me to pay my mortgage. It's more than I'm paying in rent. I was living in Sunnyside in Queens at the time. I was in a rent-stabilized apartment. It was really very reasonable for the amount. And I essentially doubled what it was costing me to live when I bought this. So a little more than doubled, actually, what it was going to cost me to live. So I really pinched my pennies and I said, what can I do? And I was like, well, I live in Manhattan this way. I can ride my bike everywhere. So I literally rode, I had a wetsuit, like not a wetsuit, but like a waterproof jacket, waterproof pants. And like, you know, I'd bring a pair of socks in my pocket so that when I got to work, I could have dry socks. And I really rode through the rain and the snow and the winter and the summer. And I did that for, you know, 8 or so years, and as you ride literally every day for years and years, you really just become
one with your bike.
Yeah, one with your bike, and it becomes a part of you. And that turned into me owning several bicycles and it becoming a hobby as opposed to a necessity. And, you know, only recently, I'm sort of sad to say this, but I just have too much to lose now. I've stopped commuting on my bicycle.
Too much to lose?
Well, it's just the truth. You know, you have somebody open a door on you, and you, like, you know, you hit your shoulder, and your shoulder doesn't feel right for 6 months. And, you know, when you're a cook or a sous chef, like, eh, well, it's not such a big deal. But when you're responsible for other people's livelihoods and a business and making it run and your schedule's not so flexible and you don't have 2 days off a week. I mean, I have 2 days away from the restaurant in theory, but I don't actually have 2 days off a week. And, you know, you don't have time to recuperate. So yeah. That's something that I just can't afford to allow to happen to
me
anymore. The
Charros are happy to hear that.
Yeah, well, I think the people in the restaurant that come in to eat every day
are happy to hear that, maybe not more than anyone else.
But yes, so that's something that's you know, it just is not realistic anymore. And I certainly get out on Monday mornings at 9 with my friend whose mother has MS, and we put like 30 on Monday morning and 30 miles, and that's sort of a quick, you know, couple of hours to in and out. I go to work, and so I still get out on my bike pretty consistently, but not anywhere near as much as I used to. But so that's sort of how it morphed into a hobby from something that, you know, was a necessity per se.
So what is it like to ride for like 100 miles? Like what happens to you? What's,
you know, that if you're in shape, it's pretty pleasant, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I've certainly done some centuries that I was not prepared for when I was younger, and those were painful. You know, like your knees hurt, your ass hurts. You know, like you're sitting on the skinny bike seat for 6 hours. Like, it's not pleasant. But when you're in shape and you're prepared for it, and like, you know, doing 30 a week, once a week, and then like I'm probably going to do the MS again in October, and if that happens, then come the end, mid August, I'll probably start doing 60 once a week. And then, and when you're like your legs are ready for it, your body's ready for it, it's really pretty pleasant. And we like hills, as like, which people are surprised by, but if you really enjoy cycling, you like pushing yourself and you like the undulation, and so it really can be pleasant. And if you're taking it, you don't take it seriously and it's not a race for you and you take it at your own pace, you get to enjoy a little bit of the scenery, and it can be really, really pleasant and fun.
So is there something, is it just a coincidence, or is there like a thing, I'm making all these connections on the show today, chefs and cycling, because I recently realized that Daniel Hume, your former boss, also is an avid cyclist.
He's a monster. He's like, I mean, I guess he's a monster in everything that he does.
Wow.
But he, I did the MS Century with him 1 year.
You did?
I did. Uh-huh. And this is, I don't know, I'm sure he's not listening, but so, but anyway, so we did this ride, and he had just moved to New York, so I didn't really know him very well. You know, he was there for like 6 months or so, and I had been working with him. And my buddy Mitch Cinnamon, who's the person I do the MS ride with, used to work at 11 Madison Park, and he had met Daniel, and, you know, we were sort of like, I was like, Daniel, this ride's really great.
Oh.
They close the FDR for the MS ride, so you do a
map. I met that dude.
He had a super nice guy. Super nice guy. So they actually close the West Side Highway and the FDR, so you do a loop around the entire Manhattan, and you go through the Lincoln Tunnel into New Jersey. So it's really a special ride.
It's pretty.
So Daniel Hume and I did the ride, and I mean, we're averaging 18, 20 miles an hour. Like, we're moving, man. That's not a slow pace. I mean, it's not Tour de France pace by any means, but like it's not a leisurely ride.
Right.
And we're about 60 miles into it, and we're like just hitting the hills in, like, you know, Rockland County, upstate New York, and all of a sudden he looks at me and he's like, I'm not going to do his voice. I can do it well, but I'm not going to.
Oh, you should do it. I love voices.
He goes, did I mention that I was the number one child mountain bike cyclist when I was in Switzerland? We all know Switzerland is certainly not flat. And then he just looks at me and he's like, I think it's time I go. And was just like, whoop, see you later, man. I was like, really?
Wow.
I'm not killing myself, but I'm certainly working here for this first 65 miles. And he was just playing with me, you know. Like, and this is nothing new with Daniel. You know, he certainly was playing with me when I was a sous chef at 11 Madison on many occasions. You know, and this is just one of those moments where I was like, really, man? I was like, you literally were like, I haven't been on my bike in 6 months, and I knew that he loved to ride, and so I was like, all right, you know, I'm like, maybe this is my opportunity to sort of like, you know, show up chef a little bit, you know? Because I had no idea. And he, like, literally waits just until, like, he can see it start to hurt. And he just, like, shoves it in there. And he's like, see you later.
Zip. Wow.
It was one of those moments.
I love that. Okay. I wanted to also thank you for
Well, for the good work that I'm impressed with the work that you do with the Brain Tumor Foundation. That's what it's called, right?
Brain mm-hmm. Tumor yeah, Foundation. Yeah, Brain Tumor Foundation.
My mom was recent. I recently learned that she was diagnosed with late stage cancer that's metastasized to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in fact, with lung cancer, what's really interesting is because it's so associated with smokers, the funding there is. There hasn't been a lot of scientific and financial attention put on lung cancer because it's like, oh, you deserve it, you smoke. But my right. mom's a never smoker, and cancer mm-hmm. can pop up in your little, in your pinky finger, really
yeah,
anywhere.
Yeah, of course.
So of course, Chris here is he's well connected in the world of brain surgeons because he's had a couple of brain surgeries, and he's vetting my mom's brain surgeon. He's gonna get vetted real hard.
Yes, well, that's of course. I mean, it's first of all my pleasure to help whenever I can. I think that's something that not enough people make time to do. You know, mm-hmm. and it's stressful and it's hard, but. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be in a situation where I was able to get the best care in New York City, essentially, mm-hmm. for this. And that's very... I witnessed how difficult it was for someone who, you know, had the best doctor on the East Coast, literally, you know,
wow.
potentially in the country. His name was Dr. Patrick Kelly, who founded this charity, mm-hmm. the Brain Tumor Foundation. And he was the dean of the neurosurgery department at NYU. And I saw how difficult it was. And I got the best care humanly possible, you know. And that's something that you shows you appreciation for... certain things, and so I've become some semi-active at least with the Brain Tumor Foundation, which is the charity he founded, and I think it's really, you know, I try to find opportunities to spread the word, but you know, we the Chatter has actually sponsored a mobile MRI unit in the Hamptons
Whoa.
Last year.
Whoa, that's so cool, important and sexy at the same time.
It's cool, you know. It shows really how supportive they are of me and
Whoa.
How appreciative I am. And I mean, it's obviously a good cause, and that's wonderful. But that was really a big thing for me and for them, I think. And you know, they scanned 150 people and they found 3 brain tumors.
What?
Yeah. So. It's really something that I'm shocked by how little information there is out there. And every time you have a conversation, you're a prime example. Everyone knows someone that's had a brain tumor.
Yep.
And it's really shocking how little, and I mean, they are, I don't know if I should say this, but they're very, there's only one way to get rid of this essentially. And that's through surgery. And it's, there's very few people that make it long term. You know, there's certain
yeah.
people that like, you know, extend their life in certain areas. And there's certain people that get really lucky, but it's really, really difficult to survive. You know, it depends on where the brain tumor is and how lucky
yeah.
you are. But you know, it's something that's very, very difficult and very unaware. And that's something that really sort of disappoints me, that it's so unbelievably common.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. That's 3 in 150 people. That's
mm-hmm.
I don't know what the odds are. I don't do math. But but that's not low, you know, and it's something that really, I mean, my surgeon performed something like 20,000 surgeries in his career, you
right.
know, and that's, even that's a, even if that's a 20-year career, that's, I mean, that's 3 a day. That's
yeah.
not, that's a lot of people with brain
that's
tumors.
That's a really long work day.
Yeah, I mean, he's 60-something, he's retiring, so like, it might have been 1 a day, you know, but like.
I'm like believing everything you're saying
but,
right now.
But really, it's something that I really think that the awareness that's not out there is really surprising, and it's, you know, my stepfather called me, you know, just 2 months ago and said one of his friends had one, and can he have the contact for my doctor, and it's something that I just, I'm shocked. Frankly, we've been very lucky. Finding money for the charity hasn't been easy, but there seem to be enough contacts to be raising a solid quantity of money to keep those things going. But
mm-hmm.
It's really something that, in terms of national awareness, I think is underdone. And you know, we're hoping to figure out a way to sort of make people more aware of it.
So when did you first, so tell me when you first discovered, you were really super young, right?
29,
mm-hmm.
and I had fainted a few times, and it sort of was one of those, I'm not a fainter,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that turned into the hospital, and, you know, they ran some scans, just sort of, you know, thinking what they were, and frankly, they think I was just overexerting myself, and they think it was exhaustion, and which isn't really a shock. If anyone gets to know me when I get worked up and I start working, that's not really a surprise that I'm not sleeping enough and working too much, or, you know, going out too late or whatever the many factors were that may have been involved there. But they did determine that that was not what the cause was. But when they ran the scans, they certainly found something that was there that was concerning. So they sent me, you know, they told me I need to see a brain surgeon. So then we went through, you know, some family contacts, and I got luckily in touch with Dr. Kelly. And so we went through and we did some scans, and he sort of recommended the three opportunities for me were A, to monitor it and see where it was going, because there's no way to determine whether it's malignant or benign until after you've gone in. So either you've done a biopsy or you've removed it. So my three options were sort of, one, go in, remove the tumor, and inspect it once it's gone. Two, sort of drill a small hole in my skull, biopsy it, and determine whether or not I need to do something about it, or sit and watch it and see if it's growing really quickly. For me, the sort of the obvious choice to me was just get out of there, man. Like if you're gonna if you're gonna perform and do anything for me, you might as well just get it out. Like, and one of the interesting things about brain tumors is that it doesn't. They very rarely actually attach to cells around them. I think it has something to do with the spongy consistency of the brain. So most other areas, and it also, which is surprising, which I'm in theory, there's two different cancers with your mother because it doesn't mastize in other regions of your body. It can hit your spinal cord, but it doesn't. Brain tumors, from what my understanding is they only mastize in the brain or the spinal cord if they're the same version of the cancer.
Right.
So anyway, it was just sort of a get it out of there sort of situation for me.
Yeah.
And we did that. And so far, knock on wood, things have been as good as they can be. It was benign. But I did, through scans, see movement. So apparently they missed because the doctor went like to me, like it literally like pops out essentially because it's not attached. So like it was creating pressure on my skull and my brain, and because it's not physically attached to the rest of the
golf ball size,
it was approximately the size of a golf ball. Yes, so certainly not small. That being said, I go in for a scan every 6 months, and you know, 5 years after that, we started seeing some regrowth happening. So we went back in and we removed it again. I figured, hey, like I've done this once, I can do this again. That time it got really hard, and that was when I decided to really sort of try and help the charity, because it was very, very painful the second time around. And that was the first time around I sort of was like, oh, well, all right, I'm done, let's go back to work, you know, and the second time around it was really painful, and that, you know, really helped, I don't know if it helped me, but caused me to want to help other people.
Well, we're gonna keep on sharing all the upcoming events with the Brain Tumor Foundation, and if you go see Chris at his restaurant, you can ask if you may touch the side of his face with the
feel the titanium screws.
He's like a Frankenstein. My last question for you is, you know, that you've definitely, you know, you've worked with so many different chefs, and last with Michael White, and now your own spot, like with the Chateau Rose. What have you learned about partnerships? You know,
I think the key to partnership is everyone rubs you the wrong way sometimes. It's about finding those people that rub you the wrong way the least. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it's like, I mean, I happen to be one of those people that doesn't hate really anyone. You know, it's just not in my nature. And I've spent my entire life working for people that were very difficult. And which made me, frankly, considerably better at what I do. And I'm very thankful to all of them for making me better at what I do. But a partnership is really, and this goes for your wife or your children or your dog or whatever it may be. This really goes to something that, you know, represents someone that you believe in and have similar thought process and understanding and desire to get, you know, certain things out of each other, and finding people that want similar things as you do in as many aspects as possible.
To make it super cold cut, it's like your incentives are aligned, and I have been really happy for you and the Chateau Rose because, you know, like I sense that you, Chris, and Zach are both super duper smart and talented, and you have, you know, stuff to prove, and you've been proving it.
That's the key. I think all of us that are in the party, that are invested at the level that we're invested, whether it be physically or financially, we all have the same, we all have feel like we have something to prove here to a lot of people. And that's something for both me and Zach and his father, Jeff. We all sort of walked into this being like, I've got something to prove. You got something to prove. So are we really going to work hard at this to like to prove to people that we're not, I don't know, terrible people, or we're as talented as people say we or thought we were, or whatever.
Let's throw Chris Cannon in there.
Well, Chris is another one that had something to prove with this. You know, it was really something that, you know, he had a, you know, an abrupt exit to the New York City scene, and this was something that he, you know, really supported us and wanted to get involved in and be a part of. And he
was the calm when you were the cray.
He was the calm when I was the cray. Yes, that is a good way to put it. But he also pushed me in particular to sort of use the Japanese side of it to offer something. I don't know if different's the right word, but
special,
intriguing.
To you.
Yeah, yeah. He really pushed hard for that, and for better or for worse, whatever we can say about it. He had something to prove because he had certainly tried to do something Japanese-ish with Bartono a long time ago. That was Italian crudo bar sort of situation, and he felt like it was before his time, and he felt like this was more of its time and ready for it. And my background sort of gave us the opportunity to do it at a level that I think most people aren't capable of executing.
And everything that Zachary's working on has been delicious tasting. I'm like loving Decoy, and I'm at Alanda all the time. So congrats to you and your team.
Thank you.
With just a couple of minutes, 1 to 2 minutes left in the show, we're going to wind it down.
Wind down.
With Chris, and find out what do you drink?
What do I drink?
When you're off work.
When I'm off work, you know, despite what my T-shirt says, I like Scotch whiskeys in general.
He's wearing a T-shirt that says more whiskey.
Yes, and I happen to really like pink wine. You know, I think that's something not enough people drink pink wine, and it's something, and I don't know why or how or what. I think it just has a nice balance between red and white. I mean, obviously it's pink, but it's just refreshing but warming at the same time. So sometimes in winter it's nice. Sometimes it's summer and it's nice. And I have a very appreciative format for that, as well as bubbles like Lambruscos and sparkling wines. I find they're certainly not for a special occasion, in my opinion. They're just delicious, and if they taste good, like why does it have to be your birthday to drink bubbles? I just don't get it. I think they're delicious. And then I happen to lean towards IPAs in terms of beers, which are a little bit more hoppy and full flavored. But I think you're right. You had mentioned that chefs drink more like common folk, which I think is not that. That's and I don't know everyone.
I like using
folk.
The word lay people.
Lay people. Uh-huh. All right. little play on words. So I think that it's you know, pink wine, really. That's what makes me happy.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I tweeted, real men drink rosé, and that tweet was very well loved.
Yeah, it's. I mean, Union Square Hospitality Group just did the rosé
campaign. I was there. I did the rosé crawl.
Mm-hmm. And it's...
Couldn't say no to that.
I don't know if it's having its moment. I've certainly been enjoying it for a long time, but... It was definitely a moment with Chris Cannon where we were sitting while we were discussing the restaurant, what we were doing. We're sitting outside on a patio at a restaurant, and Chris just looks at me and he goes, "A couple of guys drinking pink wine in the middle of the day." He's like, "I don't see anything wrong with this."
He totally sounds like that too. Yeah. Great Chris Cannon impression. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Leti.
Chris, for joining us. That was Chris Jekyll, chef partner of Alanda, the Venetian-Japanese-ish place right near Union Square in New York City. And this is Word of Mouth with Leti Hsu, that's me, on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until next time, eat well and be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.